This ROFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
How are you, by the way?
It's on me.
Hi, folks. This is Richard Hall here from Stonehenge, Aotearoa, and we're looking at the night sky. And I've got two other people with me. I can't quite remember their names. So, first of all, one of them is this lady over here.
That's me, Kay.
And there's this guy over here.
Yeah, the other guy, Keith Austin. How are you?
Okay, so look, what we're going to do, folks, tonight, we're going to start off by looking at the night sky that we have at the moment, briefly, and then we're going to get into a discussion. It is going to be a discussion and debate, bring up all sorts of things on extraterrestrial life, the origin of life and things like that. And so it can be a little bit of a debate and things like that, okay? So let's see how we go. And in fact, there's so much to talk about when you start talking about ET and that sort of thing. We'll extend this into the following programme as well. Okay, so I was just bringing up there Kay and Keith, better bring him up as well with his guitar, because Keith's also a very good musician. Yeah, first to get you come and play something one day.
Yes, I will when we get some time. Can we get some time on here?
Yeah. Okay, just first to remind you about Stonehenge itself, we're open from Wednesday to Sunday at the moment from 10 o'clock till 4 p.m. All right, that means you can turn up any time Wednesday to Sunday in those hours. But if you want to really discover what these things are all about and Stonehenge is all about, you probably need to go on a guided tour. All right. And then you get somebody like me, well, it's normally me, who takes you around and tells you all the stories from antiquity and so on. Also, the stars, because it's one of the reasons we came out to the Wairarapa, where Stonehenge is, because it's beautiful night sky out. And
yes.
So what we do is we do night skies. Now, you have to book all of these things, of course.
The guided tours and the Star Treks, yes, but you don't have to book a self-guided tour.
No, no.
The one that's on from 10 to 4.
And with the Star Trek, what we do is we take you, it's not telescope viewing this stage, we take you around the night sky so you can find your way around like a map of the world. Yeah. So that's what we've got. And, of course, we're not very far away from the spring equinox. And that's actually going to be on the day of the equinox. It's going to start at 4:30 p.m. on Tuesday, September the 23rd, which is the day of the equinox. Now, I'm sorry, folks, it is early, 4:30, but this is the only time you can actually see a special event occurs with the setting sun and the stones at that time of the equinox.
Yeah, the whole thing ends with a sunset.
That's right, yeah.
That's why it has to start a bit earlier.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's why the early time.
Yes, that's right.
And the equinox is something we can't move about. It has to be on that particular day and so on, all right? So anyway, if you'd like to come along and you get all the stories from antiquity about the spring equinox, and then hopefully if it's all nice and clear, you'll go out and you'll see the sun setting in exactly the same way as our ancestors would have seen this thousands of years ago.
Exactly the way that it set over the English Stonehenge.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And probably lots of other things all around the world, I would think.
Yes.
Some of them we recognise and some of them we don't.
Yeah, well, because these things were so important. I mean, we, as I always say, we live in a world, we've got technology all around us. We tend to forget what it would have been like for our ancestors if they didn't have that information. When to sail, when to plant, it was all done by the sun, the moon and the stars.
Think of the, you know, the movement of the stars and the planets and the moon and all that sort of thing in the night sky. That's what entertained people as much as anything else before we had devices. Mm. It was something to look at and something you could familiarise yourself with it. Mm. And the ancient people were as familiar with the constellations and the movements of the planets and that as we are with the plot, with the plots of the Kardashians or whatever it is these days. And it's just that intriguing familiarity that we have here.
Yeah. Well, people could read the stars, and by reading the stars, they had a calendar, they knew when events were going to take place, they knew how to navigate and so on. We're not taught these things anymore.
They also had a medical compendium because you know, different zodiac signs were given to different parts of the body, and then medicinal plants were classified by zodiac sign. So Gemini is your elbow, and if you knew that a plant was classified as Gemini, you knew it was good for making a poultice for your elbow.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't have people who could read, so they had to do everything with some other reference, and that was the stars, a lot of them on the zodiac.
And you always think of all the special religious festivals like Christmas, Easter and so on. What most people don't know is every one of those is identified either with the solstice or an equinox. Yes. Down through time, these have been important. And from religion to religion, culture to culture, you find that people are celebrating these festivals here. Mm.
These markers, as it were, in the sky, they were important to us because they told us when to sow, when to reap. They told us when the animals were going to be plentiful for hunting or where the animals were going to disappear. And, of course, probably the most important would be the winter solstice because that's the turnaround. Mm. That's when the period of cold and starkness, when there's nothing to hunt, nothing to eat, and you need to rely on your food stores, that's when that period is finally going to turn around and we're going to have spring again.
Unless you're in New Zealand, because it's the opposite way around. The time of starvation is actually summer.
Mm. Yeah, that's right, because there was so little food.
Winter is the time at which you could have four meals a day.
Yes. But also you notice, I mean, I come from England and the seasons were so much starker there.
That's right, it's different. You
know, when winter was winter, boy, it was cold.
If you go back to Polynesia, they're virtually the same. I mean, you know, they don't change that much. You get times of heavy rain, perhaps, you know, but it's not. You've got to think, nothing is universally the same around the world because the world's not universally the same.
No, but what we're saying here is that these events, judging by the stars, become entwined into that particular culture and then is just carried down through
time. That's right, the ones that are pertinent to them. And sometimes when they shifted, they named the new whatever it was by the old name because that's what they identified it with.
Anyway, if you'd like to come along and learn the stories of the spring equinox and actually hopefully see the equinox, there you are. That's Tuesday, September the 23rd. And all you need to do is phone up Kay at Stonehenge.
Or just book in.
Yeah.
If you go in and on the website, it'll carry you through to the booking.
It's a real learning experience. It's fascinating.
Yes. That's what fascinated me when I started studying all the things I never knew, you know, learning about these things,
where they came from.
Anyway, folks, we're returning now to night sky, and for those of you watching this on TV, you can see the night sky there, 7 o'clock in the evening tonight. That's what you're going to be seeing. And Southern Cross will be laying on its side, and that's, of course, always the first thing you look for, remember, is a Southern Cross, because it's a great pointer to finding your way around the sky and your coordinates. All right, and the Southern Cross can always be identified because it is followed by the two pointer stars, two bright stars that follow the Southern Cross around the sky. Okay, now Southern Cross points to another bright star. It's dead easy to pick out as Achernar because it's the only bright star in that region of the sky. Most of the bright stars you see linger around the Milky Way, along the Milky Way. This is well away from the Milky Way. So you find the cross and Achernar, come halfway in between, and you're looking at the south celestial pole. That's the point of the axis of the Earth pointed up into space. Drop from that point to the horizon, and you're looking due south.
I like to think of the cross and Achernar. You draw that line between the two of them, and it's almost like a great big hour hand slowly revolving in
this
the sky.
Right. Exactly right.
That's right, yes. Except, of course, it's a 24-hour
clock. This is only the start position you're looking at.
Exactly.
Well, that south celestial pole, the entire heavens will appear to rotate around that spot. Mm. Well, you see, it all depends upon how far a star is away from the south celestial pole. But the Southern Cross is just at the right spot where it actually never sets. So over the year, it's going to come down near the horizon, and it's going to turn around and come up again. Right. Mm-hmm. So the Southern Cross from New Zealand is always there. In the sky.
That's why we call it circumpolar.
Yeah.
Circling the pole.
That's right, yeah. But this is vital. It's not just a, why is the Southern Cross important? It's important because it's a navigational item. And you'll be out in the bush, wherever you are, find that object, and you've then got a point to navigate by it. Because once you know where south is, you know where north, east and west is as well.
And you can find your way out of the bush and back to civilization.
That's right, exactly, yeah. And I've used it on many occasions.
Yes, so have I, actually, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, from that, turning around from south to north, at the moment, in the early evening, we've got the most brilliant regions of the Milky Way coming overhead in the northern sky. Up near the bright region is this bright star Antares, and Antares is the heart of the scorpion, right? And so the scorpion marks out, it's our sign of that summer and that sort of thing. Right. So there's the scorpion. And following behind the scorpion is Sagittarius, right, the archer. And you can see he's got an arrow, and the arrow is actually pointed at a spot just below the scorpion's, tip of the scorpion's tail, which is the direction of galactic centre. Now, you're not looking at galactic centre. Hello, you are looking at the most brilliant region of the Milky Way there. Mm. It's out there beyond those dark clouds, something like 27,000 light years away.
And that is the hub of the central bulge of the Milky Way galaxy. Yes.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, so you've got that, and then flying up the Milky Way at this point, we've got two bright constellations, Cygnus and Aquila. All right. And we've got two big bright stars near the horizon. We've got Arcturus, which is the fourth brightest star in the sky. And Arcturus has got definite orange colour. And Arcturus is rather an important star. If we could actually get up close to it, this is what it would look like. Right? It's a giant star. Its distance is 37 light years, which is a long way, but not long compared with the distances of many other stars up there. It's 170 times brighter than the Sun, right? But its mass is only 10% greater than our Sun. Yeah. And you see, and what our Sun is, what we call a yellow dwarf. It shines out like it is at the moment, and it will so for billions of years as it converts hydrogen into helium in the thermonuclear reactions. But eventually, the Sun will run out of its fuel. And when it does so, the core will begin to collapse, its luminosity will increase, and it will turn into a red giant, just like
Arcturus. The outer layers will expand away from the core of the star.
Absolutely.
That's where you get a red giant, yes.
And so our Sun will look like Arcturus. Unfortunately, the Earth will be totally incinerated at this particular point in time. And wiped out. Okay, so this tells you that because the mass of Arcturus is similar to that of the Sun, it must be a lot older that it's in that stage, because the Sun's not going to turn into a red giant for about another 4.5 billion years. All right, so this tells us that this star is at least 5 billion years older than the Sun.
Mm.
Okay, it's one of the ancient stars in the galaxy. And that's Arcturus, and that's how we can learn about how things evolve, because what we've got is a picture book of stars and things in different stages of evolution up there. Okay, so that's Arcturus. You can easily pick that up. And I've just brought up another little picture showing you the Sun and Arcturus to scale. All right? So, its diameter is 26 times that of the Sun. So you can see how big Arcturus is compared to the Sun. But the Sun one day will be as big as Arcturus.
Yeah. It's intriguing. You think of the Sun. I mean, you see diagrams comparing the size of the Sun to the Earth, and the Sun is absolutely enormous. But then you come across a star like Arcturus, and size almost becomes meaningless.
It's bloated, though.
Yes.
It's not quite as efficient.
Yeah, well, that's why its surface, as it's shown in the picture I made up, is not sharply defined like the Sun is, the edge of the Sun. Mm. Yeah. Okay, so there's Arcturus down near the northern horizon. Following behind, we've got the fifth brightest star in the sky, excuse me, which is Vega. And looking at the two stars, you can see that Arcturus has definitely got this yellowy-orange colour. Vega is bluey-white in colour because it's a hot white star. Right? And Vega, there it is there, it's 25 light-years away and is 37 times brighter than the Sun. So it's similar in brightness to Arcturus, except that it's a much smaller star. Its surface is that much hotter, okay? And its mass is twice that of the Sun.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Now, Vega, by the way, attained a lot of fame in the movie made from Carl Sagan's book, Cosmos, starring Jodie Foster. The movie is called Contact. And Vega was the star that the purported aliens either came from or lived, or where they lived. And when they discovered, this artificial signal coming from the star Vega, there was a huge furore and that sort of thing, and they had Elvis impersonators singing Viva Las Vega, all that sort of thing. That's what I remember about Vega.
But you see, as we'll talk about later, beautiful stars like Vega and that are unlikely to support Earth-like worlds.
Exactly, yes.
So that's not where we look. It's not the bright stars in the galaxy. Okay, by 12:30 a.m. in the morning, looking to the north, the Scorpion has moved over towards the west, and almost due north will be the Great Square. It's actually dead easy to pick out, folks, because these four stars stand out, and it's a rather barren area. And the reason why I'm saying this is what we're going to see at 12:30, there's two important things in the sky at that time. Down near the horizon is Matariki. And in fact, what you're looking at is the pageant, a panorama of stars that you would see at the Matariki dawn, right? But you're seeing now at 12:30 a.m., right? So there's Matariki rising up there. But there's also a planet in the sky. And there it is there, above, it's come up above the Great Square. And that's the wonderful planet Saturn.
Yes.
It's a giant planet, but it's the most beautiful objects to see in a telescope.
Yes. Everybody's favourite planet, the one with the magnificent tiara of rings, as Carl Sagan described it.
Yeah, it looks magical. It doesn't look real when you first see it.
At the moment, we're seeing it almost side on, aren't we? So we see the rings as a very fine line.
Yeah.
You can virtually not see them because they are very thin.
Yeah, that's right. Well, over its period orbit of
many
decades.
You see pictures of it tilted so you can
actually see
them.
At the moment, yeah.
But at the moment, you're looking, in reality, looking at it side on, you can barely see the ring at all.
But in a couple of years, the rings will, the tilt will increase and the rings will...
They'll show up again.
The tilt is changing. Yeah. It's our angle of view of it as it goes around.
Yeah, but that's people expect to see it looking like that. But you do occasionally find it where you're looking at a different angle and can hardly see the rings at all.
Yeah, we're only seeing a bit, because going back looking at Matariki, it's also known as the Seven Sisters, because there's about seven stars that can be seen with the unaided eye.
Yeah.
But it's actually a cluster of about 400 stars.
Yeah.
And we're just looking at the brighter ones, the blue stars.
Yes, I had somebody in the shop who found it very hard.
Right.
She said, this Iwi says it's 9 and that one Iwi says it's 7. How many is it? I said, about 500. Well, why is it different? I said, well, because it's the eyesight of the person who was looking.
Depends how good your eyesight is.
I mean, if the person in charge says there's 7, it's 7. And if somebody writes it down in a book like that, it gets kind of stuck.
Well, the nice thing about a cluster of stars is that the cluster stars are all at the same distance, roughly, okay? And they were all born at the same time. And so what you've got is a picture of the different stars by their mass. The blue-white stars we can see here are simply the brightest stars. They're the giants. They're not the normal star.
Which may also have lost a star by now that's gone through its cycle.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Mm.
So that's what's... If you stay up to 12:30, that's what you're going to be seeing in the sky. Okay. Now, also to point out that brilliant part of the Milky Way directly overhead when the Scorpion is, we're looking towards galactic centre. And let's have a closer look at that photograph. All right. And just look at each of those little dots there is a star, distant star. And that's always what got me into thinking about extraterrestrial life, you know. Yeah. Our sun is a star, and orbiting around it are planets. And every star that you can see, and when you look at a small region of the sky here, each one of those stars is a distant sun. And almost certainly orbiting around them are worlds. Now, there used to be a theory until just recently, over the last couple of years, because we just didn't have the technology to actually detect the planets, because we always believed the planets were simply what the remnants left over from the formation of the star.
Yeah.
But that technology has changed. It's upgraded with space telescopes, and now we've discovered close on 5,000 worlds around other stars.
Yes.
And we can be pretty certain.
It's increasing quickly.
Yeah. And at the moment, the first ones we pick up are the giant planets. It's like somebody looking at our solar system from some great distance. The first planets they would see would be Jupiter and Saturn.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, of course, if you're looking for life, you want the smaller worlds, the rocky worlds, you know. Yeah. But my whole point of this is the vast number of suns out there and vast numbers of worlds as well. Okay, well... And so, of course, the great question is there life out there?
Yeah. I often talk with people about astronomy, and when my friends learn that I study astronomy, and they said, "Oh, you're an astronomer. Tell me, Keith, is there any life out there on other worlds?" And it's probably the most common question that I get asked. Yeah. There's a huge popular fascination with the idea of life on other worlds. It'll be rather depressing to think that all those stars out there and the stars and the planets and the galaxies and so forth, there's no life out there. We want to think that there is life out there. And this is where we have the fictional aliens of Star Wars, of Star Trek, of Babylon 5, all the... all the popular movies and TV series and books and stories, of course, a lot of them feature the idea that there is alien life on other worlds. So there is a kind of popular fascination with alien life, what it would be like, where it comes from, what sort of technology they might have. They might be able to fly around the galaxy in faster-than-light spacecraft like the Starship Enterprise and all that sort of thing. But there's also a serious component. I know that some of the bona fide scientists have really put their thinking caps on and come up with some fascinating possibilities of is there any life out there? As we pointed out, when I was growing up, the idea of planets orbiting other stars and that sort of thing, there was speculation. Nobody had ever seen them. Now, of course, as Richard pointed out, we've got the we've got Hubble, we've got James Webb, we've got the Kepler telescope, which looked at just a tiny little bit of the night sky for several years, and detected in just that little bit of sky several hundred planets, some of which are astonishingly Earth-like. So we come up with the idea of life on other worlds. We want to think that there's life out there. But firstly, we have to define what life is.
We come to that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, this fascination with it is absolutely crucial. And because we have only got one form of intelligent life, what we call intelligent life. I mean, there's lots of animals on this planet who think,
hey, very intelligent.
Yeah, a very intelligent, yeah.
Yeah.
Should we say technological group of creatures? We always imagine them to be roughly similar to us, you know, and also in their beliefs. So in the picture I've brought up, there's an alien there, you can see. But, hey, that alien's looking... very much human-like, you see.
It's got eyes and nose and a mouth.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and
you can always tell whether something's
a
good
one. And a bulgy head, because you're supposed to be brighter with a bulgy head.
Bulgy head, yeah. And if you're a good alien, you always tell.
Big eyes.
Because you've got big eyes, yeah. And what has big eyes? babies have big eyes, you see. Yes. So if we were a nice alien, we'd put big eyes on them and so on.
Otherwise, you've got to wear makeup to make your eyes look big.
But it always amuses me that a lot of the aliens in Star Trek appear, they look like humans with elephantiasis on the face.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Yeah, they do. They look all grown from that. The reality of the nearest thing you would see a real alien would be like this one I've just brought up now.
Okay. Exactly, yes.
And the alien would be looking at us and saying, by God, that's an ugly creature. Yeah, but what I guess the point we're trying to make here is that we set everything by our own standards, what we think is right and what is good and so on.
If you look at some of the animals and life forms that existed on Earth that are now extinct long ago, you know, and the Cretaceous and all of that kind of thing, well, they're pretty wild.
Yeah.
They look pretty alien to us.
Yeah. And look, to me, it's always what we've evolved from originally. See, you've got one going way, way back in time where a four-legged creature became rather good at things and therefore reproduced and rapidly survived. And consequently, all the creatures that have evolved from that going back in time have got four limbs.
Yeah.
But what if that creature had six limbs? We would be looking at being normal of having six limbs.
Yes.
Let's be honest, folks. Wouldn't it be fun to have six limbs? You'd do so much more, wouldn't you?
Exactly.
Having four arms.
Well, if you're like an octopus with eight, you've got eight brains as well, haven't you? Processor.
Well, nine brains, actually.
Yeah, you've got a central processor as well.
Yes. But this is why. I mean, far more pet owners have pet cats or dogs or whatever, and not too many of them have pet praying mantises or cockroaches or whatever.
Yeah.
Because it's too outside the uncanny valley, as they say.
So always when you see a science fiction movie, you can always see whether an alien is good or bad just by looking at how we portray it and so on.
People have snakes, and they're not very human-like, are they?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, but again, more people have little fluffy kittens than they do snakes.
The Americans have snakes. I don't know what that tells you, but Americans seem to like snakes.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay, so we're going to have a brief look at what is life. Okay, and I've put up here it's the conditions that distinguish living things from inorganic matter is the capacity to grow, reproduce, functional activity and continual change.
Yes. Now, the thing is, no one seems to really understand why. I mean, these are the basic definitions of what a living thing is. It grows, it consumes energy in the form of food, it grows, it reproduces, and that seems to me the most important function of any living thing, to sustain its species, to keep its species going no matter what. It responds to its environment and sometimes a very intelligent and sophisticated manner, and it changes throughout its life. And this seems to be the fundamental definitions of what a living thing is. All living things have bodies made up of cells, except, of course, the single-celled animals, which consist of one cell. But even then, the cells themselves have
community working together.
They have very definite, very different functions, which are all in common. Even the DNA, which is the code of life, the DNA is what tells a cell how to build a human or a lion or a tree or a cockroach or whatever. It's all universal throughout the entire Earth. The problem is that we only have one biosystem that we can use to study and form our science on, form our knowledge on, that on Earth. We have never yet come across another planetary biosystem. So
that's right, you see. Yeah. And of course, we can only study things that are on this planet here.
Yes.
And we look out around other worlds of how things have developed and so on. And it's very, very difficult to, when we look at Mars or Venus and things like that, and in most cases, we'll look at this in detail at a later stage, is what's on those worlds and where there's evidence of life existing and so on. Right?
Yes.
But what we need to do, first of all, is to, if we think that life is a natural byproduct under certain circumstances, it gives us a clue of what to look for elsewhere.
It's also a bit tricky, isn't it? You've got things like viruses and stuff which aren't life. They're very crystalline. They do all sorts of things, but they've got to hijack a cell in order to complete the list of life. And yet somewhere, somehow, there was a jump from that to life.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's lots of theories about that. And nobody's actually, as far as I know, quite managed to engineer the jump.
Now, if you look at these pictures, Kate, on I've just put up on the screen there, and they're actually all in different ages, you know, the one with the fish there. And if you look to on the bottom right corner, you can see the first amphibian that walked on the land, the first thing. That's going back over 300 million years. Then to the right of that, you've got a tyrannosaur and so on. You're going back 70 million years. The mammoth going back a million years ago and so on, and us.
Yes.
All right. But the interesting thing is, if you look at life on Earth, all right, it appears that life have evolved as soon as the conditions were such that it could, the planet's surface could
exactly
support
yes.
it.
Yes.
So what we're looking at is life on Earth going back 3.5 billion years. So after about 1 billion years, conditions were such that living thing wouldn't be destroyed by the environment, right? Multiple cells. But all that complex stuff that we can see on that screen there, that represents the last 300 million years.
Mm.
So for most of human history, 3,000 million years, everything was reduced to, well, most of the time, single-celled creatures and so on.
Yes.
And we could expect the same thing if we look at another
planet.
But when
you look at extremophiles, you know, the things that exist in really, really extreme conditions, like inside nuclear reactors or in super cold places or no light or around thermal vents, things like that.
We found what you're bacteria finding, thriving around
there. Yeah, they're doing really very, very well.
Yes. The thermal pools here in the North Island of New Zealand, they found bacteria which thrive in the boiling heat there.
It's just about yes. everything you can yep. think of.
That's right.
There's some sort of bacteria or something. So it's like you've got a reservoir of stuff ready to do something. Because some of our cells are really combinations of cells originally. I mean, some
exactly.
of the mitochondria yes. is like, you know, it's sort of infiltrated the system and become part of it, you know? It's
yeah.
it's a bit of a company.
So
yeah.
We have this sort of universality of life, I suppose you could call it. Again, we only have one biosystem we can use to form our opinions about.
That's right, yeah.
But life on Earth has this incredibly strong urge to survive so it can reproduce, so it can keep its species going. Very early on, the idea of sexual reproduction came about. So, of course, did the idea of carnivores eating other life forms.
But some life buds off.
Yes.
I mean, any gardener will tell you that, you know, you can bud plants, you can...
Well, listen,
yeah.
folks, we've only got through a little tiny squidget of this topic.
Yes, it's fascinating, that's why.
And we're running out of time. We've run out of time.
Yeah.
So I think we'll start off here from this point next time, looking at evolution, sexual reproduction, why it is, and so on and so forth.
Yes, exactly.
And then we gather that information so that we can begin to look what may occur on other worlds.
On other planets,
yeah.
exactly.
Okay,
yes.
folks.
Yeah.
All right, anyway, folks, I'm going to say goodnight. And Kay.
Goodbye.
See you next time, people.
Yeah.